From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, barbaric. President Obama condemns the apparent brutal beheading of American journalist Stephen Sotloff at the hands of Islamic extremists.
And those who make the mistake of harming Americans will learn that we will not forget and that our reach is long and that justice will be served.
Also today, we hear from our reporter in northern Iraq, just 40 kilometres from the Islamic State battle lines. And as the ever-deadly spread of Ebola continues in West Africa, a second US patient recovers from the virus.
David came towards me to give me a hug and to put his arms around me. And I knew how dangerous that was. And so I said, no, just no.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. France is postponing the delivery of a Navy assault ship to Russia because of Moscow's actions in Ukraine. The news was announced by the Elysee Palace on the eve of a NATO summit meeting in Wales. The Vladivostok, the first of two warships, was due to be delivered to Moscow in October. Washington correspondent Simon Marks says the Obama administration spent months urging the French to abandon the sale.
This was a very last-minute decision by French President François Hollande, the Élysée Palace saying the conditions under which France could authorize the delivery of the warship are not in place due to the ongoing violence in Ukraine. The White House will welcome this news, but will also note that it's being characterized as a delay in the delivery of the warship, not an abandonment of the sale itself. President Obama and many European leaders have been urging France to block defense sales to Moscow, and they'll continue to press the case with President Hollande when they meet him at the NATO summit in Wales.
The news comes after Russian President Vladimir Putin says he has reached agreement with Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko on the outline for a peace plan. His statement says final agreements for ending the conflict in eastern Ukraine will be made on Friday. U.S. President Barack Obama says America's strategy against the threat posed by the Islamic State is working, but will take time. He made the comments following the release of a video by the extremist group believed to show the beheading of a second American journalist, Stephen Sotloff.
The United States will continue to lead a regional and international effort against the kind of barbaric and ultimately empty vision that ISIL represents. And that's going to take some time, but we're going to get it done. I'm very confident of it.
The execution video also featured a British hostage, who the group says will be killed next unless the U.S. stops its air bombing campaign in Iraq. British Prime Minister David Cameron says the U.K. will not waver its determination to defeat terrorism. Natalie Feary reports from London.
The British hostage, who is believed to have been working for an aid organization, is shown at the end of the video as a warning that he will be the next victim of the group unless the U.S. stops its bombing campaign. This prompted British Prime Minister David Cameron to insist that the UK would not waver in its determination to defeat terrorism. British authorities say they are doing all they can to secure the release of the hostage, but the prospect of a rescue remains remote, and Britain has a policy of not negotiating or paying ransoms. How to deal with a mounting terror threat is likely to be high on the agenda at the NATO military summit in Wales, taking place over the next 2 days.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. More than 1,900 people have died in West Africa in the world's worst outbreak of Ebola, according to latest figures from the World Health Organization. It marks a major acceleration in deaths from the virus, up from just over 1,500 casualties last week. Kate Fisher has this report.
The World Health Organization says as of this week, there are 3,500 confirmed or probable cases of Ebola reported in Guinea, Sierra Leone and Liberia. One of two American survivors of the disease, Nancy Reitbol, has been talking about the moment her husband told her she'd got Ebola.
David came towards me to give me a hug and to put his arms around me. And I knew how dangerous that was. And so I said, no. Just no.
The death toll from this outbreak is now higher than in all previous epidemics since the disease was first detected in 1976. Kate Fisher, Washington.
And after making the initial decision in February, Popular American drugstore chain CVS is stopping the sale of tobacco in its 7,700 retail locations. If all pharmacies in the U.S. follow suit, the chief medical officer for CVS says it would save 65,000 lives every year. William Denzelow reports from New York.
The decision by CVS to remove cigarettes from its stores has received an outpouring of support from not only anti-smoking advocates, but the White House too. A statement from the press secretary states that President Obama has made creating a tobacco-free generation a top priority and hopes this move will set a powerful example for others to follow. Despite making an estimated $2 billion a year from tobacco sales, CVS say they made the decision because it conflicted with its healthcare mission. Members of a smokers' rights group say that while CVS has the right to change what they sell, they're falling for the anti-smoking crusade.
And that's the latest from Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
Our government determined that tragically, Stephen was taken from us in a horrific act of violence. The United States will continue to lead a regional and international effort against the kind of barbaric and ultimately empty vision that ISIL represents. Americans are repulsed by their barbarism. We will not be intimidated. Their horrific acts only unite us as a country and stiffen our resolve to take the fight against these terrorists.
The U.S. president condemning the apparent beheading of American journalist Stephen Sotloff. Mr. Obama was speaking in Estonia, where he was addressing the Baltic nations as tensions grow over Russian incursions in Ukraine. The IS crisis prompted a response from UK Prime Minister David Cameron, who says Britain will not give in to militants in Iraq and Syria, despite threats from them to behead a British hostage. The latest IS video comes ahead of a major summit in the UK of leaders of members of NATO military alliance. The video again appears to involve a British murderer. But the UK is still resisting calls from some quarters to carry out airstrikes on Islamic State positions in Syria and Iraq. Ollie Barrett will be at that summit and has this report.
I'm back, Obama, and I'm back because of your arrogant foreign policy towards Islamic State.
Another video from IS and again a British voice, now also a threat to kill a British hostage next, focusing British minds even further on what to do about Islamic State militants in Syria and Iraq. David Cameron says Britain won't be intimidated.
This country will never give in to terrorism. Our opposition to ISIL will continue at home and abroad. It is important that we are clear about the nature of the threat we are facing. It makes no distinction between cultures, countries, and religions. There is no way to appease it. The only way to defeat it is to stand firm and to send a very straightforward message. A country like ours will not be cowed by these barbaric killers. Yeah.
But the Prime Minister isn't committing to any new course of action as a result of the latest video.
We will be more forthright in the defence of the values, liberty under the rule of law, freedom, democracy that we hold dear. And I'm sure a united message to that effect will go forward from this House today.
Yeah. But Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond isn't ruling out military action at some point.
It doesn't make any difference at all to our strategic planning. As the Prime Minister said, we will look very carefully at the options available to us to support the legitimate government of Iraq and Kurdistan in defending themselves against the threat from ISIL. And if we judge that airstrikes could be beneficial, could be the best way to do that, then we will certainly consider them. But we've made no decision to do so at the moment.
But the British hosts now go into a NATO summit with Syria, Iraq and Ukraine needing attention. Only a matter of months ago, this was a summit at which it wasn't entirely clear what NATO members would talk about, with missions in Iraq and Afghanistan ending or at an end. That's all changed. And one of the main issues is how much members are willing and able to contribute in terms of resources. The UK does hit its NATO target for defence spending, as does the US, but most members don't. Surprised by the Ukraine conflict at a time many thought they could scale back military expenditure. Dr. James D. Boyes, a political historian, says until the Ukraine crisis emerged, it would have been a hard sell to voters.
in the time of austerity, how do you justify that when there is no open conflict? It's all very well and good to say now in hindsight, well, maybe we should have been spending more on defence.
It's thought NATO will agree a new 4,000-strong rapid response force for Eastern Europe to show Vladimir Putin it still means business. When it comes to Iraq, NATO says it hasn't yet received any specific request for assistance. And NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen hints that he believes the Islamic State militant group wouldn't have succeeded in taking large parts of the country if his organization had been able to stay there longer.
We had a NATO training mission in Iraq until 2011, but of course we had to withdraw because the Iraqi authorities did not prolong our security arrangements. I regret that, but of course that was an Iraqi decision and we had to respect that.
NATO officials are suggesting this could be the most important summit in its history. Iraq and Syria will be discussed by leaders. But crucially, they want to demonstrate to Vladimir Putin that the military alliance still has teeth. Ollie Barrett, London.
As the UK prepares for the start of that major summit of NATO leaders in Wales, Gideon Ruckman, Chief Foreign Affairs Commentator of the Financial Times, spoke to Fred Studeman, the paper's comment and analysis editor, and began by asking him if the eruption of both the Ukraine and the IS crises could be written off as coincidence.
Well, on one level, it clearly is a coincidence in the sense that I don't think ISIS are coordinating their actions with Vladimir Putin in the Kremlin. On the other hand, I think what you can see is a series of challenges to a global security order that is essentially underwritten by the United States, whether that's in Europe or in the Middle East or in Asia. And in a sense, one challenge provokes the other because people think, well, maybe the Americans aren't really up for it anymore. Maybe they won't push back. And if they see weakness in the Middle East, perhaps that provokes people in Europe. It's a little hard to pin down.
Is what you're saying is basically American weakness? That, you know, it's almost, I mean, we had almost the acknowledgement that, you know, our strategy is we don't really have a strategy.
Well, I mean, you're certainly, within the United States, President Obama himself is getting a lot of criticism for being, inverted commas, weak and for showing lack of resolve. Going back even actually to last summer when he drew this red line over Syria and then didn't enforce it. And you hear that also from American allies around the world. But actually, I think that's pretty unfair as a criticism, because what's happening, if you look certainly at defense expenditure, is that America is being asked to do more and more. So that if you look at NATO, which is meeting this week in Wales, 10 years ago, NATO spending was about 50% Europeans and 50% the US. As Europeans have cut their defense budgets, it's now America spending 75% of the NATO budget is coming out of the United States. And yet, actually, America is less directly threatened by events in Ukraine or the Middle East than the Europeans are. So the Europeans and indeed the Middle Eastern allies of the US and the Asian allies are all kind of looking to America to do more, even as they don't really do that much about their own security.
So do you see any of that changing? Because we've heard, I mean, the whole issue, particularly around the Europeans, about, you know, they're supposed to be meeting this 2% of GDP spending on defence, which they have, most of them haven't met for a while. We know that. We've heard that for quite a while. But do you see any shift this time? I mean, or is it just going to be the same as before?
Well, we'll see. I mean, I think it's going to be a very interesting acid test of how frightened and how seriously the Europeans take what's happening in Ukraine, because on the surface, they seem very alarmed. On the other hand, they're all almost all facing huge pressure to cut their budgets in every conceivable area. And of course, if you'll say the government of France or the government of Germany, your voters care more about their welfare payments, about their pensions, than they do about putting that little bit of extra money into defence.
But do you not think that Ukraine is going to change that a bit? I mean, one senses, particularly in places like Germany, where there has been, as you mentioned, a long sort of resistance for obvious historical reasons, but towards sort of military engagement and more assertive foreign policy and actually spending on matters like defence, that there is a sort of shift?
I think there's certainly a possibility, and I think that the US will be putting pressure on, and I think some of the European governments would like to do it themselves. But I must admit, I'm actually a little bit sceptical for a couple of reasons. Firstly, I think that faced with the choice between spending on voters and the voters feel and spending on defence, governments will still tend to spend on welfare or whatever. And secondly, European voters are much less convinced of the case for confronting Russia than European governments. So I think that actually increasing defence spending, deploying troops to the Baltic states would be deeply controversial in countries like Germany. So that's another reason why it's going to be hard for NATO to get its act together. On the other hand, I would argue that if they don't, then this sense of American weakness will actually be amplified because it's a double weakness. It's actually more in Europe than the United States, but it reinforces each other. If the Americans feel, well, look, even the Europeans aren't serious about sticking up for themselves, what really is their incentive to go out and put themselves on the line?
Gideon Rachman, Chief Foreign Affairs Commentator of the Financial Times, speaking to Fred Studeman, the paper's comment and analysis editor. Now, as US airstrikes continue to pound IS targets in northern Iraq, Kurdish Peshmerga fighters continue their battle against the militant forces on the ground. FSN's Nina Maria Potts is in Erbil, the regional capital of Iraqi Kurdistan, less than 100 miles from the US military operation. And I began by asking how people there had reacted to the murder of Stephen Sotloff.
Well, people that I've spoken to in the street here in Erbil are enormously sympathetic. Pictures of ISIS militants and combatants, wielding knives ready for execution, inspire a great deal of fear here among Kurds in Erbil. They've witnessed the beheadings of their own Peshmerga forces, Peshmerga troops that were captured in the city of Mosul. The orange jumpsuit image is very much widely feared. But I think that said, there's also a consensus that when US President Barack Obama reacts with fury and outrage, that that will also help drive more US action and support for Kurdish forces battling Islamic State militants.
Okay, with that in mind then, are you able to bring us up to speed with what the status of the current US military role where you are against those IS forces and how that's working in unison with those Peshmerga fighters and the other Iraqi security forces involved in this battle?
Well, as far as the Pentagon's concerned, they say that they've conducted 124 airstrikes to date across northern Iraq. U.S. President Obama has deployed 350 additional military personnel. That's following on from a request from the State Department, which wants more protection for its diplomatic staff in Baghdad. The White House insists that those troops won't be serving any kind of combat role. But there are questions here in Erbil over whether or not US troops are already involved in some capacity on the ground. And here I think Kurdish officials may be part company with the line coming out of the Pentagon. They seem to be indicating that they're already working with US troops on the ground, especially in coordination on airstrikes. There are reports that Kurdish troops are working with at least one US Special Forces team in coordinating airstrikes. There have been reports of about 11 teams of German commandos. I mean, it's impossible from where I'm sitting to verify those claims. But it does indicate perhaps a perception gap between what Kurdish officials are saying and what the Pentagon is saying in terms of U.S. military involvement, with the White House certainly, you know, frequently stressing that military action is targeted and extremely limited. And the Kurdish officials here talking up U.S. intervention as marking a turning point in the battle against ISIS.
And Nina, where you are at the moment in Erbil, it's not that far from the front lines of this fight with the IS militants. Do you feel safe where you are? I mean, can you tell us a bit about what everyday life is currently like against this backdrop of extremism?
People are very jumpy in Erbil. The front line is only 40 kilometres away, and there's some intense fighting still going on. So the battle is definitely far from over. There were reports at the weekend that Peshmerga are running out of ammunition just 40 kilometres away from where I am. And I would say that although Peshmerga forces and Iraqi forces have gained a lot of ground, have regained a lot of ground, the atmosphere in Erbil is tense. There are fears of penetration, infiltration by ISIS militants. There's also the refugee crisis, and that is most acute in the Iraqi Christian neighborhood of Ankawa, where I was last night talking to refugees. To some extent, I would say a veneer of normality has returned in that there are more commercial airliners flying into the airport. The airport is more or less functioning as normal. The fact that Lufthansa and Austrian Air resumed flights, which I think they're the only Western airlines to have done so, I think that that has restored some degree of confidence in the security situation here. But it's not good. I would say that aid agencies are very worried about the humanitarian situation. There are about 500,000 refugees inside Erbil and on the outskirts, with a city that, you know, used to be economically very vibrant, clearly unable to cope. So, yeah, the situation isn't normal by any stretch of the imagination.
Nina Maria Potts in Erbil, northern Iraq. And finally, tonight, FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, an update on the battle against Ebola. Yesterday, the Centers for Disease Control painted a much graver picture of the spread of the virus than previously voiced by US officials. We'll get to that in a moment. But earlier today, in Charlotte, North Carolina, one of the two American doctors successfully treated for Ebola spoke publicly for the first time. Nancy Reitbol, a missionary, was released from Emory University Hospital a couple of weeks ago, alongside her colleague Dr. Kent Brantley. And today, flanked by her husband David, she described how she learnt she had contracted Ebola in the West African nation of Liberia.
David came into our room and he said, "Nancy, I need to tell you a few things." And I said, "Okay." And he said, "Nancy," he said, "Dr. Brantley," he said, Kent has Ebola." And I have to tell you, my heart sank. Kent is not only a colleague of ours, he's a dear friend. His family, their family is a dear, dear friends of ours. And my heart sank. Kent and I had worked a lot together at the Ebola unit. And then David said to me, he said, "Nancy, I also need to tell you that you have Ebola." And I got up out of bed. And as I got up out of bed, David came towards me to give me a hug and to put his arms around me. And I knew how dangerous that was. And so I said, "No, just no." And I said, "David, it's going to be okay. It's really going to be okay."
Dr. Nancy Reitbol telling her extraordinary story in Charlotte, North Carolina. In West Africa itself, the Ebola crisis is becoming more complicated, according to US officials. They say the virus now poses a threat to humanity and should not be viewed as simply a disease affecting one region of the world. Dr. Tom Frieden is the director of the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. He's just back from West Africa, and he spoke to Jeffrey Brown of the PBS NewsHour.
Well, unfortunately, the situation is bad. It's worse than I and others had feared. The number of cases is increasing rapidly. The human tragedy is heartbreaking. And we anticipate that in the next few weeks, we're going to see significant further increases in cases and in the places where it's spreading. So this is definitely an epidemic, and really the world's first epidemic of Ebola, meaning spreading widely, and it is spiraling out of control. What's really important to understand is that we know how to control it, and there is this window of opportunity that's closing, but it's not too late. We have to act now. Urgency couldn't be higher. Well, speed is of the essence.
Tell us, I mean, you use this kind of language, the window of opportunity is closing, the challenge is so great, you said today, the epidemic is so overwhelming that it now requires an overwhelming response. What specifically did you see on your trip, and are you getting from responses from health officials around the world that is so alarming now?
Well, I'll tell you an example. Doctors Without Borders, MSF, is doing phenomenal work. They're working in extraordinarily difficult situation and trying to really do whatever they can to help patients and stop the outbreak. But they're overwhelmed by the number of patients. So they're opening new hospital beds as fast as they can, but only safety. They have a terrific track record of safety for the people working in the Ebola treatment units. But in order to do that, they can't open them as fast as the patients are requesting hospitalization. What that means is that patients are not being hospitalized and they are spreading Ebola in communities, including in urban communities where it can spread quite widely.
Well, so you said today, and you just said to us again, that in essence we know how to contain Ebola, but then why the lack of success? What are the greatest impediments and what do you most need right now?
It's fundamentally about speed and scale. Every day we delay in getting the proven treatments and prevention out there, it spreads more widely and we have more of it. One of the encouraging things I did see was people throughout the region willing to help, willing to really work to make a difference. 90% of the staff at the Doctors Without Borders hospitals are local staff who have been rigorously trained and are working hard to stop the outbreak and care for patients. But the challenges really are enormous, and the urgency is so great. The sooner we increase beds, the sooner we make burials safer, the sooner we help healthcare workers be safer from infections, we're going to be better off in terms of beginning to turn this outbreak around. Time is lives here.
What about the potential for a spread in the U.S.? And given this new alarm of how quickly this is spreading, what do you tell people tonight who are afraid here in this country?
Well, given the large increase in cases that we're seeing and think we're likely to see in the coming weeks, I would be surprised if we didn't see other cases in other parts of Africa. For the U.S., it's certainly possible we'll get someone here who develops symptoms of Ebola and may have Ebola. That's a possibility. That's why we've asked doctors working in emergency departments and elsewhere to be on the lookout for people who've been in an area with Ebola in the past 3 weeks. And if they have fever or other symptoms consistent with Ebola, to isolate them and test them. That's also why we've worked with about 10 states from around the country to have tests for Ebola up and available so that they can be tested in a regional approach. So we're prepared in this country. Ebola doesn't spread through casual contact. It doesn't spread through the air, naturally. The way it spreads is by physical contact with a sick person or their body fluids or someone who's died from Ebola with their body fluids. And standard infection control in hospitals has prevented spread of 5 cases of hemorrhagic fevers that have been in the U.S. in the past decade.
Dr. Tom Frieden of the Centers for Disease Control talking there with Jeffrey Brown of the PBS NewsHour. There is much more Ebola coverage online at pbs.org/newshour. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the programme by emailing us reports at featurestory.com, and we're on Twitter at featurestory. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside Rebecca Foster with The Bulletin. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.